You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
Let's start with our motivation. And again, beginning by all sentient beings want happiness and no one wants to suffer. And all beings have been kind to us in this life and previous lives. And will be in future lives. Because our lives are interwoven and interdependent. And also, sentient beings are kind in that our enlightenment, our awakening, depends on them. Without having compassion and bodhicitta towards each and every sentient being, there's no way we can fulfill our own spiritual aims. So when we really think deeply about that, then every living being becomes very, very precious. We see that we can't ignore even one of them, no matter how they treat us. Or how they act. And to use that as a way for cultivating great compassion and then bodhicitta with respect to each and every living being. And then to fulfill that aspiration for awakening, to generate the correct view and the wisdom realizing emptiness. So with that as our ultimate long-term aim, let's learn the Buddhist teachings this evening. This afternoon, Venerable Jigme sent a link to a talk that Michelle Obama gave in New Hampshire. Did people watch that? Okay. I highly recommend it. She was supposedly, you know, talking about Hillary for president, but actually, the first half of the talk was about respect for women and how hurtful it is, this supposed locker room talk, as if saying locker room made it legitimate. You know, if it's locker room talk, well, everybody does it, so it's okay. And that's not true. And I was very heartened, actually, that several athletes wrote in and said, we know locker room talk very well, and this is not what we talk about. Yeah? I thought that was quite, I was really proud of those athletes. But Michelle, what was so remarkable was this was not a political talk. She was talking right from her heart, and her voice was quite emotional. You know, really talking about how harmful this discrimination against women is, how it, people not taking our dreams for granted, our intelligence for granted. Not respecting, or I should say, or noticing our dreams, our intelligence, our ability to contribute. And instead, people feeling that they have dominion over women's bodies just because they're men. And she went on a lot more eloquently than I'm talking about it now. You should really watch it. Very, very moving. And especially to hear the First Lady talk like that. And of course, she talked about how harmful it was not only for the women and the girls, but also for the boys and the men. And that how is hearing this kind of talk and seeing this kind of example in powerful people going to affect the boys? And what kind of men will they grow up to be if they hear this kind of talk and this gets imprinted in them, in their minds, about how to regard women? And, you know, and of course it goes beyond women, as I said in my talk before. It applies to any minority anybody is in, anywhere. You know, this thing that we have of putting people in categories and discriminating against them. So it applies anywhere to any minority. So quite moving. And for me, it really fits in very well with Dharma. And again, as I spoke about before, the equanimity meditation and how important that is, you know, to tear down our own biases and prejudices. And how important it is, you know, because when you hear this kind of talk, it's so easy to have disdain for the people who speak like that, or disgust. I think, again, we have to separate the action and the talk from the person. The talk, definitely, we can have disdain and contempt and whatever, but not for the person. Yeah. So as a Buddhist practitioner, we want to avoid having bad feelings about the person. But we tend to mix up the person and the behavior and the talk all together, and it becomes very, very difficult to differentiate them, you know? And so we may mean to speak about the behavior, but we wind up, you know, talking badly about the person. Okay, so it's quite legit to speak about bad behavior, yeah? But it's the having contempt and disdain and rancor towards the person who spoke it or did it. That's what we want to avoid. So what can help us avoid that kind of feeling? Well, one thing I find helpful is to remember that I have all for 84,000 afflictions myself. And if you put me in certain circumstances, who knows how I'll behave and what will come out of my mouth. Because as long as the seed of the affliction is in the mind stream, all it needs is to be watered by the proper external or internal conditions. And then I act the very same way as the person I'm condemning. So to realize, you know, I don't have a privileged status that gives me the right to disdain somebody else when, in the, you know, given the proper circumstances, that person could be me speaking or acting like that. So that's one thing I find very helpful, to stop the criticism. Another thing I find helpful is to realize that all these people that we see are products of their karma. They're not real people. You know, all that's really there, whether we're talking about Mother Teresa or Donald Trump, is a body and mind. That's all that's there, is a body and a mind. And there's nothing particularly personal about a body and a mind. Yeah? That we, with our mind, project a person with a personality, with an essence of who they really are, onto that body and mind. So not only that, But that body and that mind are in constant flux. Because we might say, well, yeah, we project a person onto that body and mind, but that's fair enough. That's who that person is. But the basis on which we're labeling a projecting person is not a stable basis. The body is changing every single moment. The mind stream is changing every single moment. So even within this life, there's constant change in the basis of designation. So how can I designate some truly existent person if the base of designation, the body and mind, is in constant flux? Yeah. In other words, if I look at Trump and have contempt and anger, yeah. If I looked 69 years ago when he was 1 year old, and, you know, there was a little baby there, would I have those same feelings towards that baby? No. And yet that baby has that same name and is in the continuity of that person. And yet I surely would feel quite different about a cute little baby. Especially if I didn't know that it was going to grow up to speak like that. Yeah. But who knows when you see a baby? You don't know what the baby's going to be. So when I say Donald Trump, you know, that has to include the baby. It has to include the zygote in his mother's womb. It has to include the three-year-old. That there's nobody fixed there. And also, he's 70. What's the future holding for him as he gets older and more decrepit? And who knows what happens to the body and the mind in old age? And would I look at a senile 90-year-old person and have contempt? I don't think so. And yet the 90-year-old person as well as the 1-year-old person are all in that same continuity. Yeah. So when you look at it, you know, it's how can we form a concrete opinion on anybody? And then to realize, you know, you have that baby. How did that baby grow up to be that person who thinks and acts like that? I'm just taking him as an example. We could use anybody, you know. How come that baby grew up to think and act the way they did? That's due to karma and also due to the conditioning they have this life. So many different factors, you know. We don't know what the karma was, you know, that caused that personality. We can look and we can say that was a person who was probably generous in the past because he lives in luxury now, even though we're not sure exactly how much money he has or how much debt he has. He lives in luxury, so that comes as a result of being generous. He has a human life, and a human life is the result of ethical conduct. So that person who we look at and may ridicule now for being so unethical, at some time in that continuum, practiced ethical conduct and generosity in a previous life, because he's experiencing the result now. They're also, you know, in this lifetime, being brought up in a very privileged environment and being spoiled and having everything you want, that conditioned him. And who knows what other kind of conditioning from a previous life. I would suspect, you know, quite a temper, or quite, you know, a problem with anger or arrogance in a previous life. You know, there could be that in the previous life, or it could be that, like all of us, having the seeds of anger and arrogance in our mind stream, those seeds got especially watered in this lifetime. Certainly, the way he was brought up in the privilege that he was would water the arrogant ones. And who knows about the anger, yeah. But the point is that we come to see that this individual is not one fixed personality, you know, that there's a lot of causes, a lot of conditions going in, especially things from previous lives, you know, and that here he is experiencing the results of previous conditioning and not realizing that he's in samsara and that the actions he's creating now are going to determine and influence what he is reborn as in the future. He clearly doesn't have that awareness. And so he gleefully is creating all sorts of horrendous karma. To be born in a lowly status, to face discrimination and poverty, to be the recipient of other people's disdain. So if you look, you know, here's this person who had some good karma from previous lives. It's all getting burnt up now. And in the meantime, creating horrific negative karma that he will experience the result of in the future. And he's changing moment by moment, not remaining the same. So, who exactly are we upset with? And who are we mad at? And who are we ridiculing? Yeah? It's just karmic bubbles. Changing karmic bubbles. And, you know, in 100 years, when he's in another lifetime, we may encounter him and be very good friends. Or maybe in a previous lifetime, he was a very good friend. Or a lover. They say we've been everybody's lover. Yeah. Now for him, you may not have to wait until next lifetime. Yeah. But, you know, what I'm getting at is these aren't solid, concrete people. You know? And so, thus, there's some, you know, compassion is the call for response. Yeah? Not hatred, not using the law of karma and its effects to say, well, good, he's going to go to hell and he'll get what he deserves in his next life because of his karma. No, we don't want to have that kind of attitude. How does that kind of attitude benefit us? How does it benefit anybody? Yeah, wishing somebody else pain doesn't do anybody any good. So I just chose him as an example. We could choose Hillary, we could choose Paul Ryan. We might even choose ourselves and see what kind of karma we're creating for future lives and how we're nothing but a conditioned being, dependent on karma, dependent on the conditioning we've received this life. Okay. Okay, so this kind of reflection is completely in tune with the Dharma, and this is the kind of situation we have to apply it in. It's not just for, you know, abstract meditation. It's so we can survive this time. Yeah? Because it's very troubling, and I think a lot of people, ourselves included, are on edge because of the election. So we really need to practice and keep our own minds stable in a chaotic world, like we promised to do, like we tell other people we're doing or trying to do. Okay, so as we go through these 57 afflictions and behaviors and attitudes that Nagarjuna said we have, are the things we first have to free ourselves from in order to practice the Bodhisattva path, let's just think of how these things, when we see them in other people's lives, to remember, that's how I look when I think and act that way. And to look at ourselves and see how those same attitudes and behavior and so on manifest in our lives. Yeah, it's really rather humbling. Yeah. So the first one was wrath. Remember? And then the second one was rancor, a strong sense of resentment due to habituating yourself to wrath over a long time. Oh my goodness, what a suffering mental state that must be. Because, I mean, think of how you are when you're upset and strong wrath, wanting to inflict harm on somebody, and then think of having that mental attitude for a long time. Oh my goodness, incredible mental pain. Okay, and then concealment hides our faults and negativities from others so that they won't think we've done the destructive actions we've done. So this one's talking about hiding faults and negativities. I would think it probably, yes, and it also includes denying them. Or as we've seen, rationalizing them, justifying them. Yeah. It's locker room talk. What those women are saying is a total lie. I'm just using this because it's an example, but, you know, that we all know, okay? But I'm using it so that we look inside and find our own examples, okay? And so we can see how this kind of thing is behavior, is manifest. The fourth one was hostility, a stubborn liking for bad behavior that we're not willing to give up, even if it harms the people that we care about. On Michelle Obama's talk, below they had the comments people wrote in. Unbelievable comments. Horrible, horrible, what people were saying. Horrible. Yeah? Good example of hostility. Yeah? A stubborn liking for bad behavior that we can do in the internet because nobody really knows who we are. And we don't have to experience the results of saying those things to a real person who knows who we are. So you can write horrible things in the comment section and blast somebody totally anonymously. Huh?
They should have filters for that
stuff. They should have what?
Filters.
Filters. They should, but they don't. If you ever read the comments, you know, now that everything is interactive, people sometimes say horrible, dreadful things.
It's free speech.
Yes, it's free speech, isn't it? Yeah. So then we also talked, I'm just doing some review here, about dissimulation. So wanting a way of deceiving others that uses deception to make others think we want to benefit them when we don't. Is this prominent in the politicians around us? Yeah. Especially the ones, they support somebody, then they blame him, then they support him again. All the time, changing their mind, you know. Really, to make sure they still have a job after November. But it is making, they do it in the appearance of making others think that they really care about them. Some people probably change and so on because they really do, but the back and forth business doesn't make somebody look particularly good. Okay, pretension, pretending to have good qualities we don't have so that others will think well of us. Goodness gracious, you know, that's the election, isn't it? Yeah? And that's how we are too. We pretend that we have good qualities that we don't so that other people will think well of us because we want to have a good reputation too. We want people to think well, to speak well about us, to give us presents, to think that we're really superb. So we put on a good show. Okay? So do you see how concealment and dissimulation and pretension all kind of go together? Yeah, they're all related. They take different aspects of the same thing. Hiding our faults, presenting a false face, either by making people think we want to benefit them or that we have good qualities we don't. Yeah. Faking it, being fake, being phony. Yeah. Now, jealousy, still reviewing, the inability to bear others' good qualities or opportunities due to our attachment to receiving gifts, service, or respect. Okay? So in a Dharma way, I mean, this is the first root bodhisattva downfall. Yeah? Is in terms of doing this, if you're teaching the Dharma, you're jealous of some other teacher or somebody else, so you badmouth them out of attachment to receiving respect and offerings and so on and so forth oneself. Yeah, root bodhisattva downfall. Okay, if it's not motivated by jealousy, then it's an auxiliary bodhisattva downfall. But doesn't matter which one, we should abandon it. Okay, jealousy again, extremely painful. Yeah, we can't bear somebody else's happiness or opportunity. Yeah, we want to ruin it. It's really quite a despicable state of mind, isn't it? And yet we've all had jealousy. So these mental states, you can see how they make us suffer now and how they make us create destructive karma that will ripen in our unhappiness in the future. And how all these, you know, these things that are so involved with I, you can see how every single one of them, the concept of I, lies behind them. And how this is just, we fall into these things so easily and don't even recognize them when they're in our mind. And in fact, they give us tremendous sense of power. You know, when you have wrath or rancor or jealousy, you know, the adrenaline's going. Yeah. But you can see behind each and every one of them, there's the false conception of a real self. Then miserliness, stinginess, holding tightly onto our possessions or Dharma knowledge out of fear of giving or sharing them. Yeah? So we have something. We may use it, we may not use it, but we can't give it away. Because it's ours. And if we give it away, we might suffer. Even if we forget that we've had it because it's sitting at the bottom of a drawer for 10 years. Can't give it away. Yeah. Or even it's just a little bit of money for somebody else who really needs. Or a little bit of Dharma help, but we don't want them to know as much as us. There's some ones that come in the future that are related to miserliness will come to them. Okay, still reviewing non-integrity. Okay. So this is not abandoning negative actions out of a sense because of not respecting ourselves. Yeah? Because of a lack of a feeling of our own integrity as a practitioner or as a human being and for the Dharma that we practice. And then the one that follows that is in consideration for others, and that's not refraining from bad behavior because we don't care about the impact it has on others. And here, the speech of disparaging women, of, you know, prejudice against minorities, racial, religious minorities, disabled people, whatever kind of, you know, we all have our own things, you know, any kind of group, in consideration for others, we don't care how our speech affects other living beings. Yeah? And we're not caring. Yeah, so these two, the these two, the lack of integrity and the inconsideration for others, you know, both of them function to give us ourselves full permission to do and say all sorts of horrible things. Yeah, the first one, out of lack of respect for ourselves. The second one, not caring how our behavior or our attitudes influence other people. As if other people are just objects, potential votes. We don't really care about them, we just care about their vote. So I'm using the election for an example, but we care about everybody around us voting for us. Voting for us in the sense of liking us, speaking well about us. Okay, same thing. Haughtiness. Is this where we stopped last time? Okay. So the verse, the lines for haughtiness, says haughtiness is the incapacity of honoring others, and fury is a mental disturbance caused by anger. Mental disturbance is putting it mildly. Haughtiness as an inflated sense of self, so it's going on the side of arrogance, okay, that makes us unable to honor or respect those worthy of respect. So based on some good quality we may have, We get puffed up and don't want to show respect to those who have genuine good qualities. Okay? So this is also involved with, you know, as arrogance is comparing ourselves to others. So, you know, we have some small good quality, so we have an inflated sense of ourself, how good we are. I'm so intelligent, I'm so articulate, I'm so athletic, I'm so musical, I'm so artistic. You know, I'm so good looking, I'm so good, I'm so rich, I have so much power, whatever it is. And our nose is in the air. And meanwhile, there's people with genuine good qualities, and we can't show them any respect. We can't even see their good qualities because there's so much self-infatuation. So this is, you know, this is a problematic mental factor, because if we can't show respect to those who have good qualities, how are we ever going to learn from them? And how are we ever going to generate good qualities ourselves? And if we're so deeply insecure in ourselves that we have to have an inflated sense of self over some small quality and think that we're better than others and act like we're better than others, then we're kind of in, it's kind of sad, isn't it? You know? The people who are very haughty or very arrogant, there's, you know, it could be an inflated sense of self, but it could be very deep insecurity. Yeah? Because when you have insecurity, then of course you're trying to prove to yourself that you're really good and you're talented and you're worthwhile. Yeah, and so it comes out in that kind of haughty behavior. Haughty people are really difficult to be around, aren't they? Yeah. I find people who are arrogant and haughty very difficult, probably because I have those qualities. So I can see it so easily in other people. Okay, 12 is fury, an angry mood that wishes to engage in bad behavior. It shows on our face in the form of furrowed brows, flushed complexion, and glaring eyes. The debates. Isn't that? Yeah. This was written long before the election. Yeah. Nagarjuna lived in the second century. Yeah. Gyaltso Jay, whose commentary we're following, lived in the 15th century. Yeah. Geshe Jenpa Tekchok, whose commentary we're also following, you know, he died 2 years ago now. Long before. But describing not only what we're seeing in our eyes, but describing our own behavior. Yeah? Do you ever have furrowed brows, fresh, flushed complexion, and glaring eyes? Yes. Yeah? Yeah. We've seen you at stand-up meetings. Okay, 406. Being arrogant is being conceited. To be heedless is to not apply oneself to virtue. Pride is of seven kinds. I will now explain each of them. Okay, so here he's going to talk about arrogance as one, heedlessness as a second one, and then the seven types of pride as a third factor. So the seven are not counted individually, they're all put together as one. Okay, so arrogance is conceit or an inflated sense of self based on our possessions, good health, wealth, youth, social standing, learning, and so forth. It is a source of heedlessness. So again, you know, it's based on some small thing that we think is really fantastic. But all these, why these things are called small, is because they're unstable. They're produced by karmic causes and conditions. So come, come, go, go. Yeah? So our possessions come and go. What use is it being arrogant about them? Good health comes and goes. How can we be proud of being young and healthy? Well, we manage somehow. Wealth comes and goes. Rather silly to be proud of it. Youth. Yeah, that doesn't even come. That's always going. Yeah. At least, you know, as time goes on, you may get possessions and then give them up. With youth, forget it. It's all downhill. Yeah. And yet, boy, you know, youth is one of the big criteria for being arrogant nowadays. You know, you're with it, you're hip, you're the modern generation, you know. You're not like these old people.
I seem to remember those words from the 60s.
Yes, I remember. When we baby boomers...
No, I was in part of that generation. I was the next one. I just remember coming from that generation.
Well, I'll tell you, baby boomers were fantastic, even though many of them sold out later. But we started out good.
You said that you used the exact same words, though.
Yes, I know. I know. Every generation uses those same words about their parents' generation. Don't they? Even your generation did it.
Sure, we had other words, but meant the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So it's interesting, you know, when you kind of have young people who kind of look at you, you know, they're in their 20s, look at you like you're over the hill, and, you know, we're the with it generation. And then you meet them 10 years later, because all it takes is 10 years and you're no longer the with it generation. You know, after 10 years, you are over the hill. And there's a new generation that is the with it generation. So millennials don't get so uppity. Learn something from us baby boomers. And don't be so proud of your youth because it's going. Social standing. Oh boy. Yeah, good source of arrogance. Learning. Yes, I've studied so much, I know so much. I can explain things so well, and so forth. Artistic ability, health, or athletic ability, anything. We can get proud of anything, yeah? You name it. You can be the best toilet cleaner in the world and be proud of it. I'm serious, you know? Around here, people criticize each other because they don't clean the toilets very well. That you don't clean the toilet like I clean the toilet. I'm a good toilet cleaner. You. You just pour the stuff in and you don't even scrub it. You still have ring around the bowl. You should learn to clean a toilet like I do. Now, follow the instructions on the sheet behind the door. Can't you read?
He already looks at that sheet.
why they're not, they don't clean toilets as well as I do. Because they don't read the sheet that I wrote with incredible, I didn't write it, but I, you know, with incredible detail exactly how to properly clean a toilet. And they're so full of themselves in more than one way. That they don't realize.
She might think your haughtiness is showing.
Okay, where's the one of humiliation? No, she's been humiliated. It's a lie. It's a lie.
She's lying.
She's lying. Again. Again. She's attacking me indiscriminately for things that I didn't even do. I'm going to sue you. Yeah. Where's Fury? I'm going to sue you. Oh. My mom was really good at that one. I never became as good as her in that one.
Fury?
Fury. She was really good with that one. Okay, where were we? Oh yeah, so arrogance. Okay, it's a source of heedlessness. Yeah, but it really, you usually go, how is arrogance a source of heedlessness? Well, heedlessness, 14, is negligence and the lack of conscientiousness that wants to act in an unrestrained way. Unshackled. You are unshackled and can do and say what you want. Act in an unrestrained way without creating virtue or guarding the mind from bad activities. So arrogance gives us permission to act with heedlessness, doesn't it? And do you see how heedlessness is related to non-integrity and inconsideration for others? They all, these three really, they're good friends, you know, and they all conspire together to keep us creating negative actions. Because heedlessness just doesn't care. Yeah? It's negligence, no conscientiousness. Yeah? That wants to act in an unrestrained way without creating virtue or guarding the mind from bad activities. So I'm going to do and say whatever I feel like. I'm unshackled, to quote somebody we know. Yeah? You know, I was thinking, I'm sorry, I'm with friends, I have to go into politics. But... Okay, what was I going to say now? We used to say how wonderful it would be to have politicians who weren't responsible to high donors or lobbyists or their own parties. You know, we used to say how wonderful it would be if we could have politicians who just talked and did what they feel without playing politics to get donors and lobbyists and you know, other politicians on their side. Yeah, and we got it. And it's really made me think, you know, wow, that... You know, when a politician has to listen to donors and lobbyists and their own party and, you know, other people, it, you know, We used to criticize them for doing that because they sell out their own principles, but actually it helps, can help them calm their minds and be more practical. Yeah, it's a check and balance, isn't it? Yeah. So I was thinking how interesting that was. That is, because we used to all say, wow, that's what makes politics corrupt. And what we've seen now is that helps people, you know, be more responsible to others. Even if it's not us they're being responsible to, they're responsible to the big corporations and the people with big money, but at least they have to listen to other ideas besides their own things. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah? Yeah, it's interesting how it's kind of like the draft, you know. We wanted to get rid of the draft. And now I'm thinking, actually, the draft is something good.
Can you explain what is the draft?
Where the young men had to go for military service. It wasn't a volunteer army, but your number got called and you had to go. And everybody hated it when we had the draft. But what it did is it made the country care more about where we sent armed forces. It made people care more about getting involved in wars. And with a volunteer army, it's far away, you don't have to even think about it. Okay. So, heedlessness, acting in an unrestrained way. Then the seven types of pride. Okay, so, verse 407. Concerning these, the first is called pride. It is when one thinks of oneself as even inferior to the inferior, equal to the equal, or greater than or equal to the inferior. Okay, so this is one, but it itself, it's one of the seven, but it itself has kind of three branches, okay? So the first is thinking that we are inferior to the inferior. So here's all these incompetent people, and I'm the most incompetent one. Yeah. Here are all these people who are tone deaf and can't carry a melody, and I'm the most tone deaf and can't carry the melody, you know. Kind of like me trying to learn to play tennis, you know. Yeah, there's lots of people who miss the ball, but how come I miss it every time, you know? The inferior, most inferior or the inferior. So this really feeds into our low self-esteem. And it is a sense of pride, you know? It's because pride is, we are special, okay? We are noteworthy. We are noteworthy because we are the worst of the worst, the inferior of the inferior, okay? You ask me to cook, you probably won't ask me to cook again. Yeah, because I'm the worst cook, or whatever it is, okay? But it really feeds into our low self-esteem, okay? And what's interesting, we're proud, you know, it depends what we're feeling inferior about, but when we feel, you know, I'm the most, you know, angry person, I'm the person with the most harsh speech, I'm the person with the most, you know, bad behavior, uncontrolled mind. It's a, you know, we're proud of how degenerate and depraved we are. Yeah? It's weird, isn't it? That we can be proud of how degenerate and depraved we are. That's what that macho talk is, isn't it?
But how do you get to that?
Yeah.
Because I try to touch that pride. Like, I get the pride other places, but to get that pride that I'm the worst, I can't go there.
You can't go there? Whatever.
I don't touch it.
That pride is whenever we're sitting there bad wrapping ourselves.
Yeah, I know, but the link to get it.
I see. Yeah. It's some way of somehow we're special. You know? The whole thing of if I can't be the best, I'm going to be the worst. But I am noteworthy. I'm not like everybody else. And here, you know, especially if we're thinking of ourselves in terms of ethical conduct, then we can get very proud of, you know, like I was saying, being depraved, and that's what this whole thing of speaking bad about women are, how the men compete to see who can speak the worst in the most horrible sexist terms about women, bragging about their sexual ability or their assaults or whatever they're doing, and be completely proud of it. Yeah? Because that makes you a real man. I don't know. But that's the way people think. You know, I mean, these are afflictions, aren't they? Okay. Okay, the second branch of pride concerns thinking that we are equal to the equal. So this is the pride that competes with others. We love to compete with others. I'm just as good as you are. You know, I'm just as good, and if I try a little harder, I'm going to be better. But the mind that really likes to compete. And some people love to compete, you know. In fact, where was it? Just recently somebody asked me about competition. Maybe it was at the talk in Coeur d'Alene. Was it there? Yes, because somebody said, would we be the society with all the modern things that we have now if it weren't for competition? Yeah, somebody asked about that. Yeah, so some people thrive on that competition. And, you know, I responded that competition to be better than somebody else isn't the only thing that can motivate us to excel. Yeah. It can be compassion. It can be goodwill. It could be, you know, the challenge of really using our ability, pushing our, you know, not pushing in a bad way, but nudging ourselves forward. Yeah, there can be many motivations for excelling, not just because we want to be better than somebody else. The third kind of pride here thinks that we are greater than or equal to the inferior. So here, we're comparing ourselves to others still, but here we're comparing ourselves to people that we think are degenerate. Okay, and so we're better than those people who are degenerate. That's now talking than us, you know, us. Oh, those people who are prejudiced and bigoted and misogynistic, but we're not like that. We're better than them. Okay, so that's us. Yeah. So thinking that we're better than or equal to those people that we consider to be lowly or inferior. So again, we're competing with people that we consider best, worst, you know, somehow lower in whatever thing it is than us. And then being arrogant because we come out better than them, or at least equal to them. Yeah, interesting, isn't it, how much our mind can make up all these different ways to be arrogant and things to be arrogant about. Okay, then 408. It is presumptive pride for one to presume that one is equal to someone who is better. If one presumes oneself to be even better than one's betters, this is pride beyond pridefulness. Thinking oneself to be even loftier than the lofty is excessively bad, like developing sores on top of one's boils. It's a good analogy. Okay, so again, here, you know, pride. But whereas the first three were all in relation to somebody who we consider lower than us, now it's in relationship to people that we consider better than us, okay? So, or equal to us. So presumptive pride refers to thinking we are equal to someone who is in fact better than us, okay? So, you know, someone is a great football player and we think we're just as good as them, you know? Or that we're even better than them. Okay? Whereas, in fact, they're actually better than us. Okay? Or somebody is, you know, what's another thing? Somebody's very skilled at, I don't know, painting, let's say. But we feel like, you know, we're just as good as, or not, or even better than them. When, in fact, you know, they have more talent and more ability than we do. Okay? So this is like being uppity, isn't it? You know, isn't it uppity when you're lower but you think you're just as good or better than the people who are better than you? Okay, so that's called presumptive pride. And then pride beyond pridefulness is being especially presumptuous, thinking that we are more excellent than the people who are superior to us. So the first one, presumptive pride, they're the person we're comparing ourselves to is just a little bit better than us. With pride beyond pridefulness, the person that we think we're better than is a lot better than we are. So we look like a real jerk. Yeah? With the first one, the presumptive pride, maybe we can get away with it a little bit. But this one, it's so clear to everybody that the other person's better, but we hold ourselves as better, we look like an idiot. Okay? Okay, so Geshe Thich said, this type of pride is over the top. Oh, no, actually, I'm sorry. That's right. Okay. Yeah, because these two verses are only talking about two of them, the presumptive pride and then the pride beyond pridefulness. Okay, so the pride beyond pridefulness, you know, we're better than these people who everybody else knows are better than us. And so it's like having sores on top of boils. You know, your presumptive pride is a boil. And then you make it even worse by having sores on top of it. Okay? So, you know, we think we're the best, and, you know, and then we're the best, but we're really the best of the really good people. Yeah? So, you know, why are they giving awards and certificates out to those people and not me? And how come those people get noticed or they get to sit in the front row and not me when I'm better than them? Yeah, we really look like an idiot. Okay?
Because you have a bad karma.
So this kind of attitude that comes out in our behavior, it causes lower rebirths. And then even if we are born as a human being, we're born ugly, we're born in a low class, we're born in a way that people, you know, the opposite of being proud. We're going to have qualities that other people are going to look down on us for having those qualities. Okay, so being ugly, being foolish, yeah, not being intelligent, yeah, whatever it is. Okay, so those, we've done three of the prides, four more to go. You think you can stand it? So, 4:10, the five empty aggregates are called the appropriated, or the clung to, yeah, the clung to aggregates. When one apprehends them as I, this is called the conceit of thinking I am. Okay, so I love this, the conceit of thinking I am. There's something so completely about it, yeah. And why? Because it's based on grasping, you know, I'm a truly existent person, yeah. So based on misapprehending the aggregates, misapprehending the mere I that is imputed in dependence on the aggregates, thinking that it's a real me, and then thinking, you know, this deep-seated, like, I am, nothing's gonna destroy me. I am this inherently existent person. Yeah, I'm so important. Okay, when, again, in fact, this one makes us look, is really ludicrous, because we're not an inherently existent person, and we're not so important based on that, yeah? So this complete, it's this, you know, pride is what makes people laugh at us, isn't it? Because, you know, when we're so evident with our pride, then we really look stupid. So here, I think the bodhisattvas are probably just cracking up, you know? All the Aryas are laughing. Look at that person, they're so proud. They think that they're a real person. Ha ha ha, how stupid they are. Yeah, they must have a good laugh at us. Okay, then 4:11. To presume that one has attained a result that one has not attained is to have conceited pride. The wise know that boasting about one's negative deeds is erroneous pride. So this verse has two of them. So the conceited pride, we think that we've attained a result that in fact we haven't attained. Okay? So we have an unusual meditation, and we go, I've realized emptiness. Or we have an especially clear visualization, and Tara appeared to me. Or we had a very nice dream, you dreamt about His Holiness, you know, oh, I must have special ability. His Holiness Himself appeared in my dream, as if our dream weren't coming from our own mind. Somebody else were coming in it to appear to us because we're so special. Okay? So, yeah, just this kind of arrogance. His Holiness talks about it. I have a feeling I know who it is. But anyway, it doesn't matter. But he talks about one Westerner who came in and said, I'm an Arya Bodhisattva. And holiness. Okay. Why? And what was it he did? He had dreamed of having, a bodhisattva around him or something. He had some kind of dream. I think this was it. And he thought he was a bodhisattva because of that dream. Because one in the description of the first Bhumi bodhisattva is they can see 1,000 Buddhas. So he dreamt of a bodhisattva. And thought, oh, I must be a bodhisattva. An Arya. And then that's when His Holiness told him the other qualities of a first ground bodhisattva and asked him if he had these, in the same way that there was one person who really gave the impression that he was highly realized and all his followers saw him were going around saying, "Our teacher's an Arya, our teacher's an Arya." And he was kind of presenting himself as that way, whenever he got to the emptiness section, tears would come as, like this. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche wrote him a letter and said, the really highly highly realized yogis in the past, like Galangma Palmo, she's the one who's the head of the Nune lineage. She cut off her head, but she had the power to attach her head back on again. So she wrote to this person and said, Galangma Palmo did that. Can you show us some similar abilities that you have? Yeah, not that I know of. Yeah. Okay. I think that's quite skillful on Rinpoche's part. He just said, show us if you really like that, show us your abilities. Okay, then erroneous pride are the last two lines of 4.11. The wise know that boasting about one's negative deeds is erroneous pride. Okay, so this is boasting about our misdeeds. Again, this thing, I've sexually assaulted women. Whatever it is. In prison, I think this happens a lot too. Sometimes the young people who go to prison, from what the older ones tell me, that oftentimes the young ones are very cocky, It's like, I blasted the head off of that guy. And, and acting very cocky in that way, very proud of their negative actions, And you can see it's a desperate attempt to feel good about themselves because they can't feel good about themselves for any other reason. Really, rather... a sorrowful kind of thing. Okay, so a lot of this, when we see people really strutting and declaring their qualities, especially their negative qualities, something's really going on in their minds. Okay, so we relish our defiance and are proud of our harmful actions. There's a lot of defiance in the present election. Yeah? And a lot of what people are getting revved up on is just, it's so cool to be defiant. Because here we have somebody who's our leader who is defiant, and now we can be defiant. And we can criticize everybody we want to. And so, again, it gives you this rush and a tremendous sense of I am. Yeah. But what good does it do? So I think, you know, when we were teenagers, we were defiant. Anybody here defiant when they were a teenager? Yeah? Yeah. Oh, you weren't. Oh, you were. Okay. Oh, she wasn't. Were you defiant when you were a teenager?
Me? Come on.
See, I knew it.
Yes, I was. And I still is.
That's how you're young at heart. So we, you know, we gloat over being defiant, don't we? You know, when we were in our defiant years, and sometimes they still, we have a hangover and get defiant now too. We, you know, again, it's this feeling. Make me. Yeah, I want to see you. Make me. Who do you think you are? Yeah? Yeah? Were you defiant? You know, you're too sweet to be defiant.
No, trust me.
No, you're way too sweet.
No, it came a little bit later, in my early 20s. Okay. It was just a delayed reaction.
I see, delayed. Okay.
Right.
Act normal and be different. Yeah. That's what being a defiant teenager is. We all conform in our own defiant ways.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So let's pause here. Questions or... Let's finish the seventh one. Let's get done with pride. I don't know if I can... stomach it another week. It's good when you really get into these things and see them for what they are, aren't they? Deriding oneself, thinking, I cannot manage. I cannot manage. I'm overwhelmed. Is the pride of inferiority. Such are the seven forms of pride. In brief, oh my goodness, what's the expanded version like? So the seventh one, the pride of inferiority, makes us feel overwhelmed and leads us to think, I'm unable to cope with this. But nobody here feels that way, do you? Yeah? Nobody here works too hard and feels overwhelmed. Bunch of slackers. Okay, the pride of inferiority also arouses depression, which thinks that we're useless and nobody cares about us. Okay, because I can't manage and I'm not as good and I'm just incompetent. You know? So, we hold this wrong view, so we get discouraged, we get demoralized, and we sit and suck our thumb in self-pity. Yeah, I'm so inferior, I'm so overwhelmed, I can't manage this, this is all too much for me. You know, I can't create virtue because I'm too busy sucking my thumb and feeling sad, you know, how like inferior I am and incompetent I am. And thank you. Okay. You know, I just can't manage. This is over the top. I cannot manage. You know, don't ask me to wash one more dish or write one more email. Yeah. Or talk to one more. I better not say. Because I'm fed up. It's too much. I can't handle it. Get me out of here. I want to go to the movies. Why can't I go to the movies? Who said something's wrong with the movies? Nothing's wrong with the movies.
Newport has a nice cinema.
Yeah, it's called the Roxy. I've noticed it. Want to go? What are we going to see at the cinema? Yeah, it can't have violence and it can't have sex.
Can't go.
Yeah. Well, what about Mickey Mouse? Can we watch
No, that's got lots of problems.
Mickey Mouse cartoons. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, the pride of being overwhelmed. It's interesting, you know, isn't it? I'm inferior. You know, I just can't. Everybody else can handle it. I can't. I just can't. That's it. It's the law. Don't ask me to change.
Tried that once here, and you told me. I said I can't do it. You said yes, you can.
That was the end of the conversation.
So I stood up and whatever it
was. She did the same thing to me today.
Yeah. Write a letter to Hillary, and everybody can put their suggestions and feedback and whatever.
Send it to the YouTube channel. Yeah.
I think it'd be nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. After 9/11, we wrote a letter at DFF. We wrote a letter to George W. So, okay. Questions, comments? Yeah.
So the fourth one, the conceit of thinking I am, isn't that innate?
It's all of these afflictions have an innate form and an acquired form. Yeah. Yeah. All of them have innate forms.
But it was something. The way you began to talk is something that's thinking about our own bias. Shortly before the teaching tonight, my brother called me because I would like to see him when I go over. And my brother is a Georgia redneck old boy. And I love him. And he's a Georgia redneck evangelical Christian old boy. And just hearing him talk, I could, in the midst of all of this stuff around the election and stuff, I felt my stiffening response to my own brother to show my bias. I mean, that just showed me my bias.
Were you talking about something else?
You know, and he was concerned. How is your nunnery? Can I call it a nunnery? Is that what it is? And he was being lovely. There was no tension or animosity at all. It was simply me buying into my own stereotype of my own family.
Yeah.
And feeling the bias in the heat of all of this stuff around who supports who and what people think. And but it was, anyway, just as an example there of my own bias coming up of someone who's so close.
Yeah. Yeah, was, yeah, for sure.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, people that we care about very much. Put him in a prison, in that pigeonhole.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they're like all the other ones. Except I know them and they're a human being and I care about them. And then that creates this sense of discord. How can this be someone, like, you know, my brother, who I used to play with as a kid, who actually cares about me, but he also thinks like this? How do I put those two things together? Because they're not fitting my stereotype. Either my stereotype of what my brother should be, or the stereotype of what a Georgia redneck old boy is. Yeah, we see this a lot, don't we?
I was thinking a little bit about the how people are speaking so badly about others now in such a over-the-top way, like the comments, like you said. Mm-hmm. And I think it's how social media has just unleashed this open space for people to just bleh, you know?
Yeah.
And that's one of the negative effects of something that seemed like it was so beginning, so, you know, people can connect and da 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 and
yeah.
all that. And here's a very negative result.
Right? Yeah. Very yeah. Negative. Yeah, this came up in the Cordelaine talk too. Yeah. How we thought, you know, internet, social media, all this stuff is fantastic. And yet it does give people permission. We thought the internet was so fantastic, and yet it's given people a kind of anonymity.
Anonymity.
Yeah, anyway, you can be anonymous on it and say whatever you want and not be held responsible. Yeah, and that's not good for us, you know. And not it's not even that you're not held responsible, you know, as if other people are going around holding you responsible for everything. But we don't have to see the effects of our actions. Yeah, that's what I mean by being held responsible. That we don't have to see the effects that our words have on others and bear that responsibility ourselves. Of, wow, look what the effect of what I said had on that other human being. In a good way or in a bad way. But when you vent all your negativity, it's having it in a bad way. And then people just... they can't see it, that gives them permission. Because they might not say that at home, where they have to see the people who are hurt by it.
And that's why Michelle Obama's talk was so powerful, because she was talking about the effect on her heart of these kinds of actions and words.
Yeah, it was very personal talking. She kept going like this, you know, how it affects you.
When you're not looking at someone face to face, even on a phone or the old buzzers, you know, when you go to a door and somebody talks to you,
yeah.
When you're not looking at someone face to face, it's easier to get lost in your own projections.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the more, in any way, we're separate from someone physically, the more, the harder it is to really connect.
People like that in some ways, where they meet people online and they can project fantasies about who they are, what they might consider a positive way.
Through all the dating apps, you know, you correspond with somebody and you create this fantastic person who actually is just one that we were doing before, a pretension. Yeah? Who's pretending to be, to have qualities that they don't have. And or think, you know, pretending that they want to benefit us when they don't.
So. Well, I'm curious to know about how you changed your mind about the draft, especially since you're a former hippie. Mm-hmm. How many times in this country has there been a draft?
I don't know. I would assume when there were, so whenever there was a big war, there was a draft. And in Nam, Korea, Second World War, probably First World War.
Yeah, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War.
Yeah.
Conscription.
Conscription. I think whenever there's a war, then, you know, you called up the people to fight whether they wanted to go or not.
Yeah, so every situation, though, is horrific, whether it's the draft or not. So I'm wanting to understand.
Oh, why I think it's good?
Yeah.
Because when I was young, there was the draft, your friends were getting drafted, or you were getting drafted, or your children were getting drafted. So you had a personal stake in this war. You know, people you knew were going over there and dying. With a volunteer army, it's possible to not know anybody who's, you know, over there. We know some people now because their parents come over here, come here. You know, one person came, my son was in Afghanistan. You know, we know about people, you know, but how many people personally do we know? Yeah, that volunteered to join. So it makes, when you don't know the people personally, when it's not people you know who are there getting shot at, then the war is not touching you as much. Yeah? So that's why I see, you know, I look at the younger generation now, they're so kind of, they don't care about the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, not like we cared about the war in Vietnam. And I think part of it has to do with there's no draft, so they're safe. So, okay, government wants to fight a war, and other people are going over there and risking their lives, that's fine. I'm not involved.
The military families are deeply involved.
The military families are very much involved. But it's volunteering.
Right.
They volunteer,
right.
Which is different than getting drafted when you don't want to go.
So what you're saying is when you're drafted, it's the whole country that is involved because you never know who will be drafted.
Right.
So you're feeling... in it.
Right. And it's not a class thing. Yeah. Because now so many of the young men who volunteer, and women, it's so that they can get an education afterwards, or so that they can get health care or something. Yeah. It's a way for them to get out of poverty. And it shouldn't be like that. They shouldn't have to go through that.
It's also, there's the economic factor. The volunteer army that we have in the United States is a volunteer / professional army.
Yeah.
So they're choosing to go and get paid. And as taxpayer, there's that feeling where they're getting paid. And that was a choice, and therefore it's a job. And that's their job. So
yeah.
There's also that immediate distancing and separation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's their job. They're getting paid.
Going back to the start of your talk, when you were talking about how we analyze that people are products of their karma and that there's nothing particularly personal about a body and mind, how do we prevent that from becoming a mind that objectifies? I don't know, when I heard that, I haven't heard the teachings on emptiness, right?
Yeah.
But I was thinking, you know, when we objectify someone, it's just a body, it's just a mind.
You mean like to dismiss it? Oh, it's not a real person, it's just a body, it's just a mind. No, that's not how it's meant to be. It's meant that, you know, we project so much on there. And there's just a body and just a mind. So what in the world are you attached to? What in the world do you hate? Yeah, right.
And just knowing that that's not personal, I don't know.
Yeah, you hear somebody's personal story, but it's like then you know somebody, or it's not, you know, it has a name to it, or it seems like a real person, you know, not a real person, but it is somebody who has feelings. When you hear somebody's own story, you know it's an individual who has feelings. Yeah. But what I'm talking about is, you know, when you look, we look at people, and there's a real person there with their own personality. So there's something inside them that makes them so special for me to be attached to. And something inside that one that makes them so special for me to hate. So we're trying to overcome that view that there's real concrete people there. Yeah? I mean, a body and a mind still experience suffering, don't they? Yeah, so it's not an excuse to be apathetic. Are you getting what I'm saying?
Yeah. I'm not. And the funny thing is, I think too, when we hear someone's story, we stop having that fixed inherent view of them too. Like you said, they're complicated. They're not just one.
Yeah, sometimes when I hear a personal story, yeah, it's illustrative of a whole group. Yeah.
But doesn't that also bring to mind Chandrakirti's three kinds of compassion?
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing them, if we're really seeing them as characterized by being empty,
then
our compassion has escalates.
Yeah, because you see how much they suffer from their ignorance of not realizing that there's no real person there. And so because they think there's some real person, then all this samsara gets involved. Yeah. See, this is part of what makes emptiness scary. Yeah? Because we think, oh, there's just a body and mind. I'm just a body and mind. They're just a body and mind. Then we can do anything to them because they're just a body and mind. That's not thinking clearly, is it? Bodies and minds still experience pain. Okay? And there's ignorance there that's making the whole cycle of rebirth go on. So isn't that a cause of compassion when we see that?
I don't understand why you say it's so scary. Because you said, I can do anything. We're scared that we're going to hurt people.
No, we're scared that there's nobody there. There's not a real person. When you're really attached to somebody and you meditate on their emptiness, and you even get some glimmer of, you know, there's not a real person there, then your whole life, which is based on attachment to this person, shakes. Yeah, exactly. There's no real mudita. Yeah. And the inside of her body is all filth.
We've seen it.
You had something, Alicia? Very often they had the means to get their kids out of the draft. Yeah. But still the fact that you had to exert some effort to not be in the draft, you know, makes people think about going off to war.
During the Vietnam War, the social classes that could actually afford to go to college were different. Less people in the lower classes were able to go to college back then.
Yeah.
And so being in school was an exemption.
For part of the, being in school, you got a 2S exemption until they changed it.
Yeah.
And then everybody, school or no school, whatever class, social class you're in, everybody was eligible. Yeah, and that really shook people.
The lottery.
Yeah, when there was the lottery, it really shook people. Okay, so, oh, I just need to do the last thing. When it says, such are the seven forms of pride in brief. So brief means that it could be a summary of many different kinds of pride, or it could be a summary of what was written in the text that this was taken from. Okay, and then these 57. Yeah. And so next week we will go on to hypocrisy. Another favorite one. Okay. I'm sure people are looking. She's so arrogant teaching this. She thinks she's better than everybody else, making all these examples of all these other people who have pride of pridefulness. Who does she think she is? I exist.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lhasa's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Idam
Guru Namandala Kamiryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born of no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful tending Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.